Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here. We're talking with Lauren Fox, author of Send For Me, a novel set in pre-World War II Germany and also in Milwaukee present day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Colleen from Cumberland sent an email. She says both her mom and aunt were 100% Irish. Both are now gone. She asked them a lot of questions about their lives and the lives of their parents and grandparents, but wishes she had thought of more to ask and record. She did get to go to Ireland with them both. And she hopes to return with her children to Ireland and hopefully share some history with them. What in your own family was, I know in my family, we didn't talk as much about our own history as I wish we would have now that they're gone. What about your family, Lauren?
Yeah, nope, not at all. I think in some ways, my grandparents were trying to protect me and my brother. I think they were trying to move on, you know, in that sort of like, I think trauma does different things in different families. And one of the ways it played out in my family was just an immense amount of love and overprotection. Yeah. And also just silence. You know, I can count on one hand the number of things my grandparents said to me about their life in Germany before they left. And I was really scared to ask them. And I didn't know why. I mean, they were not scary people. They were really loving people. And I just knew it was too hot to touch. So my grandpa told me some of the stories that appear in the book grew from little seeds of things that my grandparents told me. Like he told me that one of the reasons they got out of Germany was because his best friend was in the SS and said, you know what, they're going to accuse you. This was like, you know, early days. He said, they're going to accuse you of being a communist. You need to leave. So when I was a kid, I thought, oh my God, we are here because my grandpa's best friend was a Nazi. Like that blew my mind. And so that became a story that I used in the book. But really they didn't want to talk about it very much.
You know, I'm wondering, you know, and every chapter has starts with a piece, an actual statement or statements from your great-grandmother to your grandmother. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering how difficult was it to choose those sentences or the reverse? Did the sentences, I mean, did you come on something and a phrase in a letter and did that inspire you for the next chapter or a chapter?
It was a little bit of both. It was, well, first of all, I had 25 years to work on this. it was so hard to pick out the right lines from the letters. And in some ways, I feel like I was crushing coal and finding the diamonds, you know, like they mm-hmm. were, because like I said before, so much of what she wrote was just like, what do I do with the curtains? We're going to have to sell the home. You know, when are we going to leave? I miss you so much. Just sort of like some of her letters were kind of scolding. So I thought that was kind of funny, you know, like in the midst of it all, she was still like, you forgot your coat. I bought that coat for you, you know? but in the end, I feel like I only realized this after the book was already published. But in the end, I feel like I was having a conversation with her. You know, she would say something like about that coat. And then I would write a scene about the two of them, you know, going to buy a coat together and thinking about what that would mean when they were separated and it was cold and she had to wear that coat. So in some ways there was that back and forth. I mean, it was, I want to say it was kind of organic choosing those letters, but it was also like, you know, it took me 2.5 decades to figure out which ones to use. So
there you go. Steve in Sturgeon Bay. We'll hear from you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. You can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm basically from Nina, but I live in Sturgeon Bay right now. I lived in California, just south of San Francisco, for about the last 20-some years until my wife died. The story is really about her family. The way I understand it, during World War II, her mother and father were both interred in internment camps. A lot of people don't know They think it was just the Japanese that were locked up. But no, a lot of Germans were locked up. And her mother and father actually met while they were in these camps. So that's part of the story, and that's kind of amazing. But I think it's because they weren't naturalized yet. And the other part of the story was, I think your great-grandfather or somebody like that came over during the gold rush from Germany and acquired a lot of land. And a lot of it, some of it was on Market Street, which, if you know San Francisco, yeah, the main street. He owned the land, had a hardware store, and he sold a lot of hardware, of course, to the miners, and became very wealthy. And the land later became the site of the Bank of America building. But from what I understand, he had holdings all around the Bay Area. And during the war, they just confiscated it all.
Yeah. Steve, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, of course, a lot of people were locked up in camps.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Laura in Superior, what's on your mind?
I found out something about my grandmother that no one knew. I talked to her about why my grandmother wore two diamond rings on her ring finger. And she said to me, well, your grandma was engaged to a man that was in an army training camp in Texas. And he died of, I think it was smallpox. And that was news to me. And I ended up with one of the diamonds. And I told my dad about it, and he had never heard of that. So I didn't know, you know, if that was the right thing to do. But anyway, eventually my great aunt died, and I found a letter from this young man to my grandmother, and it was sent from the army camp, and he lived just 11 miles from where I grew up. So I think it pays to ask questions when we can.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for calling. So the relative wore not only her own wedding ring, but the engagement ring from her first love, from the sound of it. And, you know, that kind of, in a way, reminds me about a character in your book. And I wondered about Oscar.
Yes, Oscar.
I wondered a lot about Oscar. Because there was a romantic tension, I think you could say, between Oscar and Annalise.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
Go ahead, talk about that.
So Annalise is happily married to Walter, and Walter's best friend is Oscar, and they are sort of a, you know, a happy a group of friends, but there's a tension between Annalise and Oscar that I was really deliberate about when I was writing it. In one version of the story, they have an affair, and then I was like, no, that's not what this book is about. Like the tension in this book is mostly external. I mean, it's about the relationships, but the darkness in the book is coming from the outside. So I was very deliberate in how I wrote Oscar, but I wanted, well, first of all, I just like writing about relationships and, you know, romantic tension and betrayal and all that stuff. So that it was just fun for me to write that character. But also I felt like Annalise and Oscar had a different connection than the bond between Annalise and her husband, Walter. Oscar, so they all emigrate to Wisconsin together. And Oscar, like Annalise, has to leave some of his family behind. And Walter doesn't have any family that he leaves behind. So he's a little bit freer and not as burdened. So I wanted to sort of explore what that sadness and sort of what that connection would mean for those two people. So there's a scene in the book where they are doing dishes together, and she imagines that he touches her back. And then you see a moment later that she had just imagined that, or maybe she hadn't. Like, I wanted to leave it sort of ambiguous, but definitely their connection is sort of like beyond what beyond her connection with Walter, but it's never going to do anything dangerous to her marriage or anything like that.
Nothing is ever going to happen, but I thought it was an interesting little side story in your book for sure. And I wondered how it got in. I got in there, so I had to ask, and Laura gave me the perfect opportunity to bring it up, as a matter of fact. Oh, man. Well, you know, you didn't write much about Ruth, Annalise's daughter, but you do spend a bit of time, more time with Claire, the more the present with the daughter, Claire, Ruth's daughter, Claire.
Yeah, right.
And those, maybe you might talk about those two women a bit, and why we got right up to the present, practically to the present day. I mean, it was 90s Milwaukee, I guess, 1990s.
Yeah. I think do we have another hour to talk about why I didn't write about Ruth? Ruth is the sort of direct corollary to my actual mother. So I think in retrospect, maybe I don't know. I mean, Claire is the character who most resembles me. And I at first had really shied away from writing that contemporary thread. I thought the book was entirely historical fiction. And my editor was actually like, you know, I think she understood what the book was about before I did. She was like, this book needs a contemporary piece. Like, it's about intergenerational trauma. You need to write the character who is like you. So in some ways, I feel like writing about Claire was kind of writing about Ruth. Like, Claire is sort of the blank slate and everything is handed down to her, but she has no actual memories, you know, certainly no memories of being in Germany, just the experience of being raised by these immigrants, you know, with all the love and confusion and complexity of it all. So, and I felt like the big tension in her story is, you know, if you fall in love with someone who has ties to another country, how do you reconcile the possibility of having to leave your family? So in some ways, I felt like writing about Claire was really writing Ruth's story as well.
It was it was really interesting to me. And so you felt a little bit like Claire at times?
Yeah, I mean, my husband is from Ireland, and we met in Minneapolis. And I mean, for a long time, the biggest question in our relationship was like, where are we going to end up and how are we going to make it work? Because, you know, he doesn't have a son. Matthew, the Claire's boyfriend, has a son in England, because I wanted to up the stakes. You know, I wanted to make it even harder for them to consider, you know, where they would live. My husband does not have a son in Ireland, but, you know, still it was a huge question for us. Like, how do you choose your own happiness? And what does that mean? And like, what if you have to, like, to be happy, maybe sometimes you have to leave your family of origin behind. And it's just a really, I think life just plays out the way it plays out. I don't even have an answer for that. I mean, I have the answer as I wrote it in the book, and I have the answer for my own life, but I don't really know what the right answer is.
So what was the best part for you of writing this book?
The best part is always in every book I've written is the moment when like time passes and you don't realize it. You know, you're just the characters are talking to you and you're deep in the creative process. It's kind of rare to achieve that moment. But this book, I felt I got there several times, just like feeling like I was so connected and like my heart. This is the book of my heart. Like I felt like I knew these characters and I felt so like I loved them all, you know?
Yeah.
So being deeply immersed in the writing process was really magical.
Well, I tell you, I think anyone who reads the book comes to love the people. You write with such, you're such a vivid writer. You write your attention to detail and the emotion that you bring out between all the various, the mothers and daughters, is so genuine. It's just I'm telling you, it's a great experience to read your book. I really loved it myself. And what a great way for us to start our year, every 3 months or so, we do another Larry Mueller Show book club. And what a great way to start this year. Thank you very much, Lauren, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. I enjoyed very much talking with you.
Thank you. Me too.
Lauren Fox, our guest today, and her book, if you haven't read it yet, get a copy. It's, take a look. It's Send for Me is the title. Lauren Fox, the author. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, coming up, we're after our news break, we're going to take a look at Jewish immigration in Wisconsin and the history of the Jewish folks in our state. That'll be coming up right after a look at the news. And I hope you'll stay with us. You're going to enjoy that as well. I'm Larry Mueller with Lauren Fox, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we just finished talking with author Lauren Fox about her novel, Send for Me, based on letters from her family taking place between the eve of World War II Germany and present-day Wisconsin. And we're going to continue exploring now Jewish history in our own state after the war and how populations have evolved. And our guest is Sheila Terman Cohen. She's the author of Jews in Wisconsin. She's also written three other books for the Wisconsin Historical Society and currently works as a freelance writer. So as we talk with Sheila Terman Cohen, I hope you'll join in. Do you remember when Jewish families started migrating after World War II? What do you want to know about Jewish history in our state? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Sheila Terman Cohen, welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you so very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've listened to your programs for many years.
Oh, I hope you had a chance to hear at least part of Lauren Fox's, the Lauren Fox interview as well, just before you came on with us.
I did, and I'm going to get the book. It's on my list now.
It's a lovely book. What did Jewish populations look like in Wisconsin right before World War II?
Well, I think before talking about the Jews right before World War II, it's important to acknowledge that the Holocaust, although the most recent wholesale atrocity against the Jewish people, was certainly not the first. Since their origins in Mesopotamia 4,000 years ago, Jews had been subject to very brutal anti-Semitism that forced them to leave their homes and search for other places. Notable examples were the Crusades of the 11th and 13th century, in which non-Christian infidels, both Jews and Muslims, were slaughtered in great numbers. And then there was the Spanish Inquisition of the 1400s. So anti-Semitism that Jews encountered in this country and in Germany, going back to the mid-1920s and leading up to World War II, was not a new phenomenon. So you want to know what things were like for them prior to World War II?
About right before World War II. What did the populations look like? Were there a lot of Jewish folks in Wisconsin, and where were they?
2 or 3%, and most of them were in Milwaukee, but a lot of them had ventured into smaller towns like Appleton and Stevens Point, Sheboygan, La Crosse. So they were pretty much spread out into the state by that time. But ironically, in the early 20s, leading up to the war, the Jews in the state and all over the country were more prosperous than any time since they had entered the country in the 1800s. But as the decade progressed, the sign of anti-Semitism began to rear its head. As you know, after World War I, our economy started to plummet, leading to the Great Depression in 1929, and Jews were blamed for that for some reason. Do you remember Father Coughlin, the Catholic priest from Michigan who hit the airways in 1920? Well, no, you wouldn't have remembered that, but he hit the airways in 1926. And he had a weekly ministry in which he spewed out anti-Jewish sentiment to vast audiences, including WIBA in Wisconsin, claiming that Jews were in control of the financial institutions. Henry Ford, one of the most influential industrialists of the time, handed out a brochure with every one of his Model T Fords saying that espousing a conspiracy theory that there was a Jewish secret society that was about to take over the economic and political world. So it was a time when the Ku Klux Klan had reemerged, this time the target being Jews, Irish Catholics, as much as African Americans. And quotas on both educational opportunities and immigration were put into place. As an example, there was the Johnson-Reed Immigration Act of 1924, and it limited immigrants, all immigrants, but this really affected Jews because there was such a small number in the first place, to only 2% of those already in the country. Ivy League schools began to close their doors to Jewish students, and I will add here that thank goodness for Governor La Follette, because on the contrary, he felt that people of diverse backgrounds should be part of the university. And actually, the University of Wisconsin during that time became a haven for Jewish students. But it was not a good time for Jews right about that time. Jewish enrollment in the Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons dropped from 50% in 1923 to 6% by the end of the decade. So, and people looking for homes or rentals, it was not uncommon to find no dogs or Jews allowed. And I had a chilling moment when I was doing my research at the Wisconsin Historical Society when I came across a lovely brochure from Wildwood Resort in Lac des Flambeaux that while extolling the virtues of the peace and comfort in the North Woods also assured, and I'm quoting here, our policy does not permit any except Gentiles. No undesirables are ever entertained. So it was not a good time for the Jews right before the war. And this is going back all the way to the mid-20s. But simultaneously, in that same time period, Germans were licking their wounds because of the defeat in World War I, and unemployment was out of control. The economy was about to collapse. And so there was a rise of anti-Semitic and nationalistic feelings, which I believe brought Hitler to power in 1934, as he was espousing eradicating anyone without pure Aryan blood. As Hitler took over, there were harsh restrictions placed on Jews, including the fact that they needed to wear a gold star on their outer garments at all times to differentiate themselves. And it was a shock to the Jewish people, both in America and Germany, because the German Jews at that time felt every bit as much German as their Christian neighbors and were full participants in the German society, and they really couldn't believe what was happening. But on November 9th, 1938, known as Kristallnacht, meaning Crystal Night, there was a very loud awakening for the Jewish people when the windows of Jewish storefronts and homes were shattered in brutal, brutal attacks by Nazi troopers. And so by 1939, 300,000 Jews had escaped.
And some of them came to Wisconsin.
And some of them came to Wisconsin, yes. Some of them came to Wisconsin, but not right away, I will have to say. Not right away, because there was a period after the war, after 70% of Europe's Jewish population had perished in gas chambers or starved in concentration camps, that the Congress was actually debating how many people to admit. And there was a bill put up by Alexander Wiley, who was a U.S. senator, saying Jews could not enter after 1945, which was a tremendous jeopardy to Jews who were still being persecuted even after the war in places like Poland. So eventually that date was expanded and 400,000 DPs were allowed into the country. 80,000 of those were Jewish. But they languished in DP camps for a while before this country actually admitted them.
You know, it actually, as we're talking about this, it makes me think about the Ukrainian refugees that are suffering from the Russian invasion right now. Is there any comparison, or how would you compare what they're going through now to what Jewish people have faced?
Oh, so much so. My heart goes out to them for their courage right now and their will to create a democracy or keep a democracy. And in that way, I just feel that nobody in this country should ever take for granted all of the courage and will it took our ancestors to come here and have a democracy. It's nothing to ever be taken for granted. And there's a very large comparison.
I would think so. I think Milwaukee and Madison had the largest Jewish populations in the state. Probably about second half of the 20th century. Is that correct? And why would that have been the case?
That's true. But to understand sort of the geographical locations of the Jews, you have to understand that there were two very different groups of Jewish populations here. One came from the German Confederate in the 1840s, and unlike predecessors who fled horrible attacks, these people came to better their opportunities in the New World. On the contrast, those Jews who came from Eastern European countries about 40 years later did flee horrible attacks by the Tsarist Russian regime called pogroms. And they were very different people than the Germans they encountered here because they had no opportunity for a secular education. They were impoverished. They came with ragtag clothes on their back. And although the German Jews certainly stepped up to the plate at that time and helped their Eastern European co-religionists, they never lived in the same geographical area. So while a lot of the German Jews left Milwaukee for less competition in the 1850s, they ended up leaving in the 1920s, and the Eastern Europeans replaced them into the small towns of Appleton and Sheboygan, all the other ones that I had named before, and were really quite prosperous there. It wasn't until the 1950s when several factors occurred that that created sort of a emigration from the small towns and back into the large ones. First of all, the GI Bill came about after the war, which allowed veterans to take advantage of education, and so people left in that way. But also, the Eastern European Jews had become prosperous enough at that time to send their own children to college. And when the kids left, many of them did not return. Another factor that caused the Jewish shrinking in the small towns was the founding of large malls, shopping malls, because it put out of business all of the ma and pa stores that had evolved from the Jewish owners that were in the small town. Yeah. Maybe some of your listeners remember stores or have heard stories about stores like Felix General Store in Viroqua or Lippmann's Furniture. There were just lots of little stores like that, and they just couldn't compete with the big malls. So many of the Jews left. Some remain, and also some synagogues remain there that service Jews from areas around. But for the most part, yes, the Jewish population is in Milwaukee and Madison.
Yeah. I was thinking back as you were talking to a professor I had, when I was working on my master's degree, he and his wife and family had moved to become an assistant professor here, and they lived in a small community. Well, they lived in Stoughton, I believe, and he said we were, at one point in one of his lectures, I forget how it came up, but he said we discovered we were the only Jewish family in Stoughton, and of course that was a long time ago. I have no idea what that's like now. But
well, it's possible. It's possible. Although you can find Jews almost everywhere, at least one family somewhere. Yeah.
Well, how did the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, how did that affect Wisconsin's Jewish population, or did it?
Well, it did. It did. In the 1880s, well, I'd say the 1870s to the 1880s, Jews were not allowed out of Russia as a whole. They were called refuseniks because as many times as they tried to apply to get out to the out of the country, they were refused. The Jews in this country were very concerned about that, and they rallied and petitioned Congress to do something about it. And in 1974, there was a Vanek Act passed that said Russians could have fair trade status with our country if they were to allow some of the Jews to leave. And at that time, I actually met a young man by the name of Leonid Borstein, who had left at the age of 17 before his parents did. He said it was my only opportunity to get out because they were keeping us stuck in a country where we weren't wanted. His parents eventually followed, but in the 80s, again, the door closed. That was in 1974. And it wasn't really until Glasnost, when Gorbachev took over, that Jews were freely allowed to come to this country, in spite of lots of rallies all over the country from United States Jews to allow Jews to enter.
On the face of it, it doesn't seem to make sense. If you don't want a particular people, and they want to leave, why wouldn't you just let them leave?
Good question. It doesn't make any sense at all. As Leonid said, we were stuck in a country that didn't want us.
I just have such a hard time understanding the thinking behind something like that. Well, what do the Jewish communities look like today in Wisconsin? I know some synagogues have merged or even closed perhaps by now in the state, but are places of worship still thriving for Jewish residents?
Yeah, as I said, in the small communities, there are still some left in Wausau, La Crosse, Green Bay, and they service Jews from areas close by, but not in the city. People come from other areas. Definitely in Milwaukee and Madison, I would say the Jewish population is thriving. There are about 33,000 Jews in the state right now. And I would say from being peddlers of junk and fruit and that sort of thing, I would say they've established good businesses and have done very well and have certainly educated their children and I think are really integral parts of the Wisconsin fabric at this point.
Oh, yeah. And perhaps in our last minute, some thoughts on, did you enjoy, I must have enjoyed interviewing for your book, Jews in Wisconsin. I believe you interviewed a number of residents.
Oh, I did. And I wish I could really, I know it's the last few minutes, but I interviewed wonderful people who were actually integral parts of the war. One was a chemist at the McArdle Lab by the name of Vaclav Szybalski, who was one of the people known as the Righteous, who helped. He was a Polish Catholic who helped Jews escape. There was another one, Renata Laksova, who was a geneticist at Weissman Center, who was part of the transport of Jews, 669 Jews out of Czechoslovakia. There was somebody by the name of Alfred Beter in Milwaukee, who actually was in the Dachau concentration camps. All of these people just filled me with such admiration. And I wish I could really tell their stories, but they're in the book.
Sheila, it's such a pleasure. I'm sorry we are out of time because I know there's a lot more you can tell us. And as you say, probably the best way to do it would be to take a look at your book. Sheila Terman Cohen is the author of Jews of Wisconsin. She's written three other books for the Wisconsin Historical Society and served on the board of directors of the United Refugee Services of Wisconsin. She works as a freelance writer. But the book we were kind of talking about is Jews in Wisconsin. The author, again, Sheila Terman Cohen. It's wonderful to have her with us on the show today. And it's certainly wonderful to have you listening today. And as I look ahead to tomorrow, my goodness, it's already Friday. And we'll be talking with the author of Straw Bale Gardening coming up. We'll talk about the benefits for individuals and communities with this method of growing plants. Been a great show. Thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.